Bibles to Psalm 132. Psalm 132, and as BJ stated in just a moment, we want to deal with some psalms that focus on the kings of Israel and Judah. And we want to see how these psalms find their fulfillment in Jesus. Before we begin looking at the psalms, let me say just a couple of words to you all. Thank you so much for the kindness that you have shown me from the beginning of my arrival here until this last moment. You have been very gracious and very kind, and I recognize that in this short time, I'm going to leave out some things that I'm sure that I ought to mention. But I appreciate the opportunity to be with you. I have been able to see people like BJ and Kylie, who I knew in Tampa and from around there, and Heather, who I also had as a student in college, and it's good to see them doing well and the Lord blessing them spiritually. And I did not realize that Brad was here. I roomed with his brother Chris when I was in college, that even though I didn't know he was here, some reason I recognized him right away. And I don't know what that was that gave it away, but I just thought, that's Chris Simmons' brother. And so it was good to see them. And the elders have been very gracious and kind. As John and Jack picked me up at the airport last week, and it's been good to be with them, and Brother Miller as well. And I appreciate so much BJ and Jack and the good work that they're doing here in preaching and teaching. And I also have a list right here of all of you who I have eaten with this week. And thank you very much. If you get a mean letter from my wife, it's because you fed me too much. But I have enjoyed it so much. I know that takes of your time and it takes of your money. And you are doing that just because of our common love for the Lord. Thank you so much for that kindness. And thank you so much to Esther and Dave for their kindness in keeping me this week. They have been very gracious hosts and supplied me with all I needed, sometimes more than I needed. As I try to put my socks to be washed a moment ago, and Esther says, no, you need new socks, and I'm going to hand you those. So I appreciate it. But I appreciate their kindness very much. And listen, like I said, I could say many things that I didn't. But this is my hope, that we all get to spend eternity with the Lord, and that we will have plenty of time to be lost in praise to Him and to tell each other how we have helped each other make it along the way. That's our goal. And may God bless you and bless me to this end. I know some of you face struggles in your life and trials. Hold on to the Lord, and the Lord will hold on to you. As Acts 20:32 says, I commend you to God and the word of His grace, which is able to build you up and give you an inheritance among those who are sanctified. But Psalm 132 is where we'll start. Kings, very powerful in the ancient Near East. Usually in nations, there was no system of checks and balances. There was no legislative and executive and judicial branch that were separated. The king was all of those. And the king was highly respected in the various nations. The king was expected to fight the people's battle and to judge for them. And God promised Abraham from Genesis 17 verse 6 and Genesis 17 verse 16 that kings would come from him and Sarah. And that promise is a promise that God made and God kept. And the greatest king in the Old Testament, in a very real sense, is David. And God makes great promises to David in 2 Samuel 7. David's conscience bothered him because he lived in better quarters than the Ark of the Covenant, than God's dwelling place. And he says in that particular passage, he says, I want to build the Lord a house. And the Lord says, no, I'm going to build your house. I'm going to establish your dynasty. And after you pass away, your sons will be raised up to sit upon your throne. 2 Samuel 7, a very important passage in the history of the Old Testament. And in Psalm 132, what you basically have is a poetic retelling of 2 Samuel chapter 7. 2 Samuel chapter 7 that we mentioned just a moment ago. This psalm in Psalm 132 is based upon two oaths. It's based upon David's oath to God that he would not give sleep to his eyes nor slumber to his eyelids until he has built a dwelling place for the Most High God. But also we have God's oath to David in verses 10 through 12. For the sake of David your servant, do not turn away the face of your anointed. The Lord has sworn to David a truth from which he will not turn back. Of the fruit of your body I will set upon your throne. If your sons keep my commandment and my testimony, which I will teach them, their sons also shall sit upon the throne forever. So what this promises, to give you a very brief description, and let me tell you this, as I've tried to say several times this week, you're going to be benefited from this lesson more than anything, more than listening to it again, which you're welcome to listen to it as many times as you want. That's not going to hurt my feelings. But the thing that's going to benefit you the most is reading the text over time after time and kind of using this as just a springboard to help you get deeper into the text. But the thing Psalm 132 tells us about this king is this king will be a descendant of David, that God will raise up one to sit upon David's throne. And you may notice that verse 11 is quoted in the New Testament in Acts 2 and verse 30. That's quoted on the day of Pentecost by Peter. But we're trying to build a picture from a few Psalms. What was this king to be like? What was this king to be like? Psalm 45 is the next psalm that I would have you to turn to, which talks about the king. And here in Psalm 45, the text emphasizes, there's no psalm really like this psalm. This psalm is more about the king and in praise of him than it is God. It's more directed. It's a song, it seems to be composed for him on the day of his wedding. And notice some things it tells us about the king. In verse 1, my heart overflows with a good theme. I will address my verses to the king. My tongue is the pen of a ready writer. You are fairer than the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips. Therefore, God has blessed you forever. Now, looking there in Psalm 45, and we're going to make some other points, but the first point I want you to notice from here in verse 2, what it tells us, it says that you are fairer than the sons of men. One of the points it makes about the king is the king is the best looking of men. The best looking of men. In 1 Samuel chapter 9, the Bible emphasized 1 Samuel 9, 1 Samuel 10, that Saul was good looking, and from his shoulders up, he was taller than any of the people. In 1 Samuel 16, verse 12, when David is introduced, he's introduced as a good looking person. And you remember Absalom makes a bid for the throne. In 2 Samuel 14, verse 25, there was no one as good looking as he was. And the same kind of statement is made about Adonijah later in 1 Kings 1, in verses 5 and 6. The point I'm making is the king was an ideal. The king was to be the best looking of men. And therefore your looks played a part in those narratives. It's called attention to emphasize that the people were watching this. The people were looking for this kind of king. He is the best looking of men, but notice also that he is described as the most mighty of men. He's the most mighty of men. Here in verse 3, gird your sword on your thigh, O mighty one, in your splendor and in your majesty. And in your majesty, ride on victoriously. For the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness, let your right hand teach you awesome things. Your arrows are sharp. The people fall under you. Your arrows are in the heart of your enemy, of the king's enemies. So notice in verse 3, the king girds on his sword. In verse 5, he shoots his arrows and people fall under him. This king is not only the best looking of men, he is the most mighty of men, the mightiest of men. All his enemies fall before him. Remember how the people want a king to fight our battles in 1 Samuel chapter 8. The king is the best looking of men. The king is the most mighty of men. And the king fights not simply for conquest, not simply for power. He fights for the most noble of causes. Notice in verse 4 what the text emphasizes. It stresses that this king fights for the cause of truth, meekness, and righteousness. You remember the old Superman television show. And Superman fought for truth, justice, and the American way. The point was, he was strong, he was mighty, and he was always allied with truth. He was fighting on the right side. And this is the kind of king that Psalm 45 is picturing. He fights for the most noble of causes. He fights for meekness and truth and righteousness. And also, this king is a holy man. In verses 6 and 7, the text emphasizes that this king, it says, "Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of uprightness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of joy above your fellows." You have loved righteousness and hated iniquity. May God give us a love for Him and for all that is right, and a hatred for all that is evil. And you notice this king is portrayed in the most ideal of terms. This king is pictured as the ideal man in all of these ways. This is everything you would look for in a leader. Now you might be asking yourself, how many kings of Israel and Judah fulfilled that picture? Well, let's look at Psalm 2 just a moment. "Why are the nations in an uproar and the peoples devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand. The rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed. Let us tear their fetters apart and cast their cords asunder." In the book of Psalms, you often find people asking why, as they wrestle to understand their circumstances in light of a God who is loving and good and holy. And they cry out, "Why, O Lord, You see an example of that in Psalm 10. Why do you stand afar off, O Lord? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? But I want you to notice in verse 1 of Psalm 2, the question why is asked. But the question why is not asked, God, why are you standing so far away? The writer cannot believe man's insane hostility against God. And friends, you don't know how many times that I have looked at the events in our world and quoted this verse. Why are the nations in an uproar and the peoples devising a vain thing? All the most powerful men in the world seem like they try to ally themselves together against God and against His power, and they throw off His yoke because it represents slavery to them. But they are no challenge to the Lord. In verse 4, he who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. He will speak to them in His anger and terrify them in His fury. But as for me, I have installed my King upon Zion, my holy hill. Now it's verses 7 through 9 of this psalm that I'm going to mainly focus on. I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as your inheritance, and the very ends of the earth as your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron, and you shall shatter them like earthenware. What I want you to see, particularly from this psalm, its contribution tonight, to trying to get a picture of what God said this king was going to be like, this king who descended from David was going to be like, it emphasizes that this king would exercise universal dominion. Ask of me, and I will give you the nations as an inheritance. You shall, it's like he will rule with a rod of iron. And the nations will be fragile pieces of pottery which will easily break before the all-powerful king from David's line. But one more we want to look at right now before we try to pull some things together, and that is Psalm 72. Psalm 72, as we try to get a picture, what was this king like? How is he portrayed? This king that will descend from David. How is he portrayed in these royal psalms? He is a descendant of David, the best looking of men, the most mighty of men. He fights for the most noble of causes. And he is a holy king. He will have a universal dominion. There are two points that I want to emphasize in Psalm 72. This king will have a universal dominion. In verse 8, may he rule from sea to sea and from river to the ends of the earth. Verse 9, let the nomads of the desert bow before him and his enemies lick the dust. Let the kings of Tarshish and of the islands bring presents, and the kings of Sheba and Seba offer gifts. And let all kings bow down before him, and all nations serve him. Now there, verses 8 through 11 sounds a lot like Psalm 2, verses 7 through 9. In Psalm 2, he's going to rule over the nations. They are like a fragile piece of pottery, and he will break them with the rod of iron. Here in Psalm 72, he's going to rule, this king is going to rule from sea to sea, and all the enemies will come and bow before him and kiss the ground before him. All kings will reverence him. All nations will serve him. So this text emphasizes the universal dominion of the king. And this king, in this text, emphasizes that this king will do justice and righteousness. Justice and righteousness. In verse 1 through 4, you see this emphasis. Give the king your judgments, O God, and your righteousness to the king's sons. May he judge your people with righteousness and your afflicted with justice. Let the mountains bring peace to the peoples and the hills in righteousness. May he vindicate the afflicted of the people and save the children of the needy and crush the oppressor. He is to do righteousness and justice. That's one of the highest compliments that could be paid to a king in the ancient Near East, that he did justice and righteousness, that he did what's right, that he governed in fear of God and in concern for the people. You see that in 2 Samuel chapter 8 in verses 15 through 18 about David. David ruled in justice and righteousness. It said about Solomon in 1 Kings 10 and verse 9. It said about Josiah in Jeremiah 22 verses 15 and 16. This king would be much different than the kings of Assyria and the kings of other nations if you look at verses 12 through 14. He will deliver the needy when he cries to help, for help. The afflicted also, and him who has no helper. He will have compassion on the poor and the needy, and the lives of the needy he will save. He will rescue their life from oppression and violence, and their blood will be precious in his sight. Archaeologists have found monuments that the kings of Assyria left behind. Their monuments did not sound anything like verses 12 through 14. Their monuments boasted of their brutality, how they cut off limbs, how they poked out people's eyes, how they chopped off people's heads, how they skinned them alive, and used the skin and draped it across the walls of the city. That's the things the kings of Babylon boast, the kings of Assyria boasted about. But to be a king of Judah and Israel that God is looking for, that God is speaking about, to be a king like this, you show your power not by trampling over the weak, but by caring for the weak. He showed his power by having compassion on the poor and the needy and counting their life as precious in his sight. Now, we can make a lot of statements contrasting this with our leaders. But isn't it a sad thing that in a nation where people once ran for political office by kissing babies, they now run for political offices for promises to kill them in abortion? These kings did justice and righteousness and sought to rescue those who were poor. Now, I want you to think with me a second. And I recognize that the more you know of Israelite history, the more meaningful this is going to be to you. And I invite you, if this is new ground to you, don't let that overwhelm you. Use that as a reason to start studying these things and to think about these things. But when you read the books of Kings and Chronicles, when you read those books, is what we read in these royal psalms, does what we read in the history of Kings and Chronicles match the expectations that we would have from reading these royal psalms? Do we see kings who were the mightiest of men and the most noble of men? Do we see kings who exercised universal dominion? Do we see kings who did justice and righteousness when we look at the history of Israel? Now, if I were teaching this in a class, I would ask you to raise your hand. And I would say, at what time did Israel and Judah, at what time did they exercise the kind of universal dominion that they did, that is described in Psalm 2 and Psalm 72? When did Israel in their history exercise that kind of world dominion? But let's just try this. How many of you would answer it by saying the days of David and Solomon? Anybody want to raise their hand? Okay, several brave people raise their hand. And it's brave because, and I'm politely saying this, no, that's wrong. That's the closest they ever came. That's the closest they ever came. But the point, they never exercised that kind of dominion. They never exercised it. Let me illustrate from the last five kings of Judah. The last good king of Judah was Josiah, who was king from 640 to 609 B.C. He was a good king of Judah. He's the one who hears the book of the law read and he tears his clothes. He tears his clothes. He mourns. He grieves at the sin of the people. He does justice and righteousness. Did he exercise world dominion? Do you remember how he was killed? He was killed by the king of Egypt when he was opposing the king of Egypt going up to help the king of Assyria in a battle against Babylon. It's recorded in 2 Kings 23 and in 2 Chronicles chapter 35. He's the last good king of Judah. He's the last one who did justice and righteousness, but he didn't exercise worldwide dominion. Josiah was followed in office by his son Jehoahaz. Jehoahaz only reigns 3 months. After he reigns 3 months, the Pharaoh of Egypt, who had killed his father, comes and takes him off of the throne, takes him into slavery in Egypt, and Jehoahaz, did I say Jehoahaz a second ago? Okay, I got it right then. Jehoahaz lives the rest of his life as a slave in Egypt. Okay, next is Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim first comes to the throne. He's placed on the throne by Egypt. Because because Babylon defeats Egypt, he has to switch to Babylon. Then, after a battle, and I know this is getting complicated, but after one battle where the Egyptians defeated the Babylonians, Jehoiakim switched back to Egypt, and Babylon comes against him in full force, surrounding the city of Jerusalem with armies. What I'm trying to illustrate in the midst of all that, and I know I went through that quickly, and I apologize for that, but what I'm trying to illustrate, they weren't the greatest of the kings of the East. He's followed in the throne by Jehoiachin, who reigns 3 months. 3 months before he surrenders to the Babylonians and he has to be taken into captivity. And I've always found it humorous. I don't know if you will. But Jehoiachin surrenders to the Babylonians with his mother. What kind of a powerful king is that who's going to fight your battles with you? You need to take mom with you to surrender to the Babylonians. And then Zedekiah is the last king of Judah. He doesn't submit to Babylon as Jeremiah teaches him to. He is captured by the Babylonians. The Babylonians say, bring his sons out. And while Zedekiah is watching, his sons are killed before his eyes. And then the Babylonians put out his eyes. The last thing this king of Judah ever sees are his sons killed. And he has to live with the memory of that the rest of his days. Now I want you to think about this. If you looked at those promises in the Psalms, did those promises seem to match their history? those last four kings I mentioned, Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, Zedekiah, all of them are said to be evil in the eyes of the Lord. They didn't do justice and righteousness. And they certainly didn't exercise worldwide dominion. Did God's promises fail? Did God's promises come short? How can we reconcile history with what we know from these Psalms? And this is a question that Psalm 89 asks. This is a question that Psalm 89 is asking. And Psalm 89 celebrates, in Psalm 89, verses 19 through 37, the text celebrates God's covenant with David. But then in verses 38 through 52, the writer pours out his heart and he grieves over the fact that these promises to David seem to have failed. He says in verse 38, "You have cast off and rejected. You have been full of wrath against your anointed. You have spurned the covenant of your servant. You have profaned his crown in the dust. You have broken down all his walls. You have brought his strongholds to ruin." Now this is what happened to the kings of David. "All who pass along the way plunder him. He has become a reproach to his neighbors. You exalted the right hand of his adversaries. You have made all his enemies rejoice." You promised to exalt him, to make him the highest of the kings of the earth. But you have exalted his enemies. I want you to notice what is said in verse 49. "Where are your former loving kindnesses? Where are your former loving kindnesses, O Lord, which you swore to David in your faithfulness?" If you study Psalm 89, what you will find is both of those two Hebrew words for loving kindness and faithfulness are both used seven times. Every time before this occurrence, it is celebrating God's loving kindness and God's faithfulness, and particularly God's loving kindness and God's faithfulness as He fulfilled them in the covenant with David. But He looks at the history of His people. He looks at what happened to kings like Zedekiah, whose eyes are put out after he witnesses his sons being killed. And he says, "God, what happened? What happened to your promises to David?" And the psalm ends with those questions being unanswered. But this teaches us a principle of interpretation. Anytime it seems like God's promises have failed, just wait. Because God has a good record as a promise-keeping God. And when we open the first verse of the New Testament, what does it say? Jesus Christ, the Son of David, the son of Abraham. And that phrase, "son of David," is going to be used some nine times, eight or nine times in the Gospel of Matthew. What this is telling us, though the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah, their history doesn't match what we would expect from these royal psalms. They don't live up to these lofty ideals of all a king should be. But that doesn't mean God's promises have failed. They merely foreshadow the ultimate King of Israel through whom all God's promises will be fulfilled. Now, let me stress to you a couple of things. You might ask, why do you use this lesson last in this particular week? Why do you use this lesson last? Let me tell you one reason. Because it gives us a way to interpret the Old Testament that Jesus is the fulfillment
of the whole Old Testament.
And I had a teacher that said, and I often say in class, a teacher that I had that used to stress this, he said, you may have, like me in my Bible, in the period between the Testaments in my Bible, between the Old Testament and New, I have a list of prophecies made about Jesus and a list of prophecies fulfilled by Jesus. And he said, it makes some good points. It tells you, like in Isaiah 7:14, behold, a virgin shall bear a child. And it tells you in Matthew 1:22 and 23, you have a fulfillment. But he said, remember this. Any list of Old Testament prophecies fulfilled in Jesus is too short if it doesn't include the whole Old Testament. Now, it will take you, I think, a lifetime of thought and reflection to fully appreciate that. And I come to a fuller grasp of that all the time. That all the passages of the Old Testament find their fulfillment in Him. While those kings did not live up to expectations, those kings were a disappointment and not a fulfillment. Jesus is all that they never were. He is the ultimate king. And many of these psalms are taken and quoted of Jesus in the New Testament. Let me illustrate. In Psalm 2 and verse 7, the Bible says, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Those words are quoted and applied to Jesus at his baptism in Matthew 3. In verses 16 and 17. Those words are taken and applied to Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. In Matthew 17, in verse 5. In Acts chapter 13, in verse 33. Paul preaches at the synagogue of Antioch and Antioch of Pisidia. And he quotes this as being fulfilled in the resurrection. You are my son. Today I have begotten you. So what I'm trying to emphasize is the New Testament takes those promises that were made in the royal Psalms and applies them to Jesus and shows He is the ultimate fulfillment of the promises that God has made to David. What happened to your former loving kindness and faithfulness to David, what happened to it, it finds fulfillment in Jesus as King. Let me emphasize something else to you. And let me ask you to think with me here. That Jesus is different from all other kings. And He fulfills this in a way no one else could, no one else did. Let your minds go with me just a second to the book of Esther. King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes. Do you remember what happens in Esther 1? His wife, Vashti, won't come for him. He summons for her. Vashti, come here. Or gets his men to. She won't come. This sets off a crisis in the palace. The king says, what am I going to do? His wise men says, she has not only insulted you, she's insulted all of us. And now all women are going to feel free to disobey their husbands. And you set forth a decree that anyone who doesn't, any wife who does, every wife must listen to her husband. And that you're going to put Vashti away and you're never going to let her come into your presence. So the king writes this decree. And in Esther chapter 2, the king's heart longs to go out to Vashti. His men say, let's call in all the beautiful young virgins of the land, all the beautiful women in the land, and let's choose from them a king. This is what I want you to understand. In this Medo-Persian kingdom, everyone was there to serve the king. Everyone was there to serve the king. And so he calls all the beautiful virgins and they come to him. And he's going to be with all of them. And he's going to select from them a wife. But if he doesn't select you as a wife, you're still part of his harem. He may never call for you again. You may never go into his presence the rest of your life, but you're part of his harem and you're deprived of the right of being a wife of another man. So think how many wives of the king live lonely and disappointed lives, and how many men in the Persian Empire were deprived of wives because the king took all the beautiful young virgins. But again, all the people in Persia were there to serve the king. And he didn't only do this with women. He did this with men in this sense, not that he was involved with them romantically, but he took the young men and brought them into his service, made eunuchs of them and brought them into his servants. And he did that with all the men in Persia that he wanted to be his servants. When you were king of Persia, when you were king in the ancient Near East, all the people served you. Just ask you a question. How many people do you think who are running for political office are really doing it because they want to serve the nation or serve you? Are they more interested in what they're going to do for you, or are they more interested in what you're going to do for them? Just think about it. With Jesus, we don't have to think about it. When the apostles were arguing about who was going to be the greatest in the kingdom, Jesus said, greatness among my people isn't measured the way it is in the world. Greatness among my people isn't measured by how many people serve you or chant your name when you go by. Greatness among my people is measured by how many people you serve. And he said in Mark 10 verse 45, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life a ransom for many. This king is not interested in everyone serving him. This king is interested in serving his subjects, in serving this whole world. And let me encourage you to do this. I want you sometime to take out a concordance and I want you to look at references in the New Testament that describe Jesus as king. And you know what you're going to find? You're going to find that there are a heavy dose of those references, a heavy concentration of those references that describe Jesus as king that surround the cross of Jesus. Remember the statement in John 19, verses 19 through 22, that Pilate has written above Jesus' head in three languages, "This is Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." His enemies complain, "Don't say he's the King of the Jews, but say he said he's the King of the Jews." And Pilate says, "What I have written, I have written." But Pilate's declaration was truth, that Jesus was king. In a real sense, the throne from which Jesus served was the cross. You see, he wasn't one that was coming as a king into this world to take all the beautiful virgins for himself and for his satisfaction. He wasn't coming calling all the young men in his service to become eunuchs to do everything that he was asking. He comes as king into our world of sin and suffering to save us. Here truly was one king among all the kings of all time who truly had the best interest of his people at heart. He is different from all the rest. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. And I want to tell you, Jesus has fulfilled these royal psalms. But he will fulfill these royal psalms. What do I mean by that? Well, Jesus is king. Right now. He's king right now. But his kingdom is not all it's going to be. Look at 1 Corinthians 15. I'll begin in verse 22. For as in Adam all die, so also in Christ all will be made alive. But each in his own order, Christ the firstfruits, afterwards those who are Christ at his coming. Then comes the end, when he hands over the kingdom to the God and Father, when he has abolished all rule and authority and power. For he must reign until he has put all enemies under his feet. And the last enemy abolished is death. For he has put all things in subjection under his feet. And when he says all things are in subjection, it is evident that he is accepted who put all things in subjection under him. Verse 27, which says he's put all things in subjection under him or under his feet, is, it seems to be language from Psalm 8 and verse 6. But this language that's used there in verse 27 and in verse 25 of putting all things under his feet, that language also goes back to Psalm 110, verse 1. Remember, Psalm 110 says, "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet." That is a royal psalm. We didn't discuss it. There were other royal psalms we didn't discuss, but Psalm 110 is a royal psalm. Point is, Jesus reigns right now. He is king right now. But one day, there will be no one who will deny that. There'll be no one. As Romans 14 says, as Philippians 2 says, every knee will bow and every tongue will confess. There will be a universal proclamation of Jesus Christ as king. All history is moving toward that day. And all history is moving toward recognizing Jesus Christ as king. Every knee will bow. Every tongue will confess. And those and the last enemy to be put under his feet, as David defeated one foe after another in the Old Testament, his victories foreshadow the victories of the Messiah, but the Messiah shows us the main enemies of mankind are sin and death. Sin and death are the main enemies. And Jesus Christ is victorious over these. He provides us forgiveness of sins via the cross. And He gives victory over death via His resurrection from the dead. And one day all that are in the graves shall hear His voice. They that have done good to the resurrection of life. They that have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. Keep serving Jesus as King, because that places you on the right side of history, and we will share in His victory. A teacher was, she taught second grade, and she told all the students the first day that she didn't have favorites. She loved all her students equally. But it was hard to practice. It was good in theory, it was hard to practice. And she particularly had one boy who disturbed her, because he was handicapped. He was 12 years old. He was older than the rest of the children. He was often a distraction to them and a distraction to her. And finally she determined, I just cannot put up with this anymore. And she called in his parents for a conference. She said, listen, we're not being fair to Jeremy. Jeremy needs to be in a special school. And she tried to present it in the best light. She said he needs to be in a special school. And he needs to be among children that are like him. And his parents started to weep. And his father spoke respectfully and said, there is no school like that around here. He says Jeremy's life expectancy is so short, and there's so few things he enjoys, and this school is one of them, and we don't want to take it away from him. The teacher thought to herself, I'm not dealing with this right. You know, these people are losing their son. They have to deal with him all the time. I can put up with him in school. And she agreed to what the parents were saying. She would keep him in class, and she determined that she was going to communicate better with the parents and letting them know the assignments and letting them know what he was supposed to do and kind of helping him. And he was making some progress as the year went along, and she kept in touch with the parents, and she told them about assignments that may seem to be difficult or he didn't seem to grasp. Things were going better. It was near the end of the school year. It was spring. And she came in with the kind of homework that kids like. She gave all the students a large plastic egg, empty on the inside. And she says, your job is to go back and to put something in this egg and bring it to school tomorrow, but to put something in this egg that indicates new life. Spring is a time that dead things come to life, and put something in the egg that signifies that. And all the students listened with excitement. And that's fun. That's a fun assignment. All of them listened with excitement except one. The bewildered look on Jeremy's face told the teacher he didn't understand a word of what she'd said. She made a mental note of it. I'm going to call his parents as soon as I get home. But she got home, and there was supper to cook, and there were jobs to do, and she forgot about calling his parents. The next day, after they'd done a couple of assignments, she says, it's time to open your eggs. And as she would open these eggs, she would praise the student who brought these eggs. She opened one up, and it was a rock with moss on it. And she said, that's good. That indicates dead things coming to life. You've understood the assignment. You've done well. Another had placed in a plastic butterfly in the egg that almost looked real. And several things like this. And each time the teacher would stop and comment on what the student brought and say, that's great. You understood the assignment. You did well. You did great. But about halfway through, she opened up an egg that was empty. And instantly, she knew whose egg it was. And instantly, she remembered her fault. She remembered that she'd not called his parents, and she doesn't want to embarrass Jeremy. And without saying a word, without praising him, without saying anything about it, she laid aside the egg to get a new one. But he wasn't going to let it die that easy. He said, teacher, you didn't say anything about my egg. And she's almost disgusted now. And she says, Jeremy, it was empty. And he responded, so was the tomb of Christ. And the teacher was overwhelmed at this piece of brilliance from this handicapped boy. How did he think of such a thing? And not knowing what to say, she said, Jeremy, why was his tomb empty? And he said, because evil men put him to death, but God raised him from the dead. And at this point, she's so overwhelmed with emotion, she had to dismiss the class and to collect her composure. As the story is told, that summer, Jeremy passed away. But each of his classmates, remembering what he did, brought a plastic egg, empty inside, and placed it on his casket. Because the tomb of Jesus was empty. One day, the tomb of all who believe in Jesus